If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Russia and the West, Obama abroad, contraception in the Supreme Court, mudslide disaster in Washington State. President Obama rallying the West in Europe.
If anyone in the Russian leadership thought the world wouldn't care about their actions in Ukraine, or that they could drive a wedge between the European Union and the United States, they clearly miscalculated.
Protesters pro and con in Washington as the Supreme Court heard arguments on contraception, corporations, and the Constitution.
Pro-family!
One more!
Pro-family!
Pro-birth control!
And a deadly mudslide in Oso, Washington. One survivor described the speed of the wall of mud.
It must have been going 150 miles an hour. I mean, I just had time enough to say, oh my God, and then we were hit.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Robert Costa of The Washington Post, Margaret Brennan of CBS News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Does the West look strong? Strong enough? How about Obamacare? And should the Constitution allow a religious conscience to corporations? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington, Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Robert, welcome back to On Point.
It's great to join you.
Great to have you. And from Washington, Margaret Brennan, correspondent for CBS News covering the State Department and Foreign Affairs lively realm this week. Margaret, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Robert, and Margaret.
Let's go straight to the president in Brussels on Wednesday talking about solidarity in the West.
The United States and Europe stand united on this issue. We're united in our support for Ukraine and for the need to provide economic assistance to help stabilize its economy. We're united in our commitment to Europe's security. We're united in our determination to isolate Russia and impose costs for Russia's actions.
Margaret Brennan, at the end of this week, the president in Brussels, and lots of talk about Ukraine and Crimea. How united do the United States and Europe look against what we're told are troop movements on the Ukraine border and broader concerns?
Well, certainly the U.S. and Europe are united in purpose, but they're not in perspective. In other words, they don't necessarily have the same common interest or the same risk here when it comes to the Russian threat to cut off or to suspend some of the economic ties between the two. I mean, Europe has been saying we are united and may continue to ratchet up sanctions against Russia, but they are very much concerned about blowback in a way that the United States isn't. But what we are going to see, particularly next week at the NATO meeting that Secretary Kerry will attend, is a conversation about how the U.S. and Europe can really make NATO look even stronger, to have a common purpose to say we will defend these territories militarily that are under the NATO umbrella, and we're serious about that. The problem is all those other little countries and interests in between, like Ukraine, that don't fall under the NATO umbrella, but might be on Vladimir Putin's radar to try to increase his sphere of influence. And that's one of the concerns in the Obama administration.
Of course, President Obama talking this week about U.S. investments in defense versus European defense investment. He was in Rome talking with the Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, praised the International Monetary Fund for their offer of $18 billion in assistance to Ukraine, but said as a whole, European nations need to spend more.
We can't have a situation in which the United States is consistently spending over 3% of our GDP on defense, much of that focused on Europe, potentially more if we end up having ongoing crises within Europe, and Europe is spending, let's say, 1%. The gap becomes too large.
The president saying, step up on defense spending, please. Europe, Robert Costa, do you see the West, and it's a funny phrase, we haven't used that much in some years now, but this week presenting a credible counterweight to Vladimir Putin's Russia?
I think so. I think we've seen since Russia went into Crimea, a real reassertion of President Obama's foreign policy and an articulation of what it means to him when he speaks of the West and when he speaks of Western Europe. And I think we've seen a stability now in his rhetoric and his vision that maybe wasn't there in the early days when things were a little more chaotic with what Putin was doing.
Is he getting support in Washington? Is there support across the aisle this week, Robert, by your measure for his efforts?
Yes and no. Because it's an election year, House Republicans have a lot of differences with the president when it comes to what kind of aid they're willing to do. They think the administration's focus and the extent of the aids and the dollars from the U.S. are a bit too much and not focused enough. But you're not seeing a widespread disagreement on foreign policy from a strategic standpoint from Republicans. There's a quarreling on tactics, but not on the big picture.
Jack Beatty, what do you think of President Obama's performance this week? You know, throughout this Ukraine crisis, he's been very carefully staying away from anything that sounds like war and yet trying to present a strong counterweight and give Russia plenty of reason not to go further. What do you say to his performance, Jack?
Well, he pretty much seemed to accept Crimea as a fact on the ground. I mean, I think he used that phrase. There's nothing to be done there now. And he tied further sanctions to further Russian incursion into eastern Ukraine. Now, whether that will follow or not, we don't know. It is telling, though, that the Ukrainians, who are, after all, the Kiev government, an official there referred to the sanctions so far, quote, as a mosquito bite. And the Europeans, according to the reporting, were uneasy even with those sanctions as the American government unfolded them. And partly they were uneasy because they felt that the American information about the bank that's being sent, you know,
Bank of Russia,
Bank of Russia, and about the oligarchs around the pals of Putin, that information came from the NSA, and therefore it was sort of tainted in their eyes. And, you know, meanwhile, back home, it may be true, as Robert says, that the president is showing a strong profile, but the public doesn't seem to think so. By 59%, Americans disapprove of his performance, highest of his presidency. Just in January, they thought he was fit. There was 50-50 on his diplomacy. Now people disapprove of it by 17 points. The polls don't say why. Is it that he's not tough enough? Is it that he's too tough? And so it cries out for interpretation. And one interpretation, it seems to me, is those, you know, 90-minute phone calls to a man who loathes him, Vladimir Putin, from the White House. And the White House played up that so much. He's calling, he's working, wow. And it was all unavailing. And maybe the voters, maybe the public just said, we don't want our president, you know, using up his prestige in this feckless way.
Robert Costa, you're our national political reporter here. How do you read those worsening poll numbers on the president's favorability ratings in this? Is it the standoff with Russia? Is it something else?
I think it's a variety of factors. I'm not so sure, though. I think Jack's right that the president's foreign policy has had some kind of influence on his poll numbers, and his poll numbers have not been especially strong in recent months. But I think what you're seeing now from Republicans is they're urging a more aggressive stance from the president on Ukraine. You had Buck McKeon, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, starting to talk about Russia's incursion into Crimea as a war and a real more Cold War posture from Republicans. But because the situation is confusing and it's almost ever-changing and evolving, I would point to Obamacare, the economy, as more significant factors in the president's poll numbers right now.
We'll look at Obamacare. Let me get a quick call before the break. Madison, Wisconsin. Carol, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
I am so disturbed
by the comments this week from Mitt Romney and Donald Rumsfeld regarding President Obama. And for the record, I'm a white woman. But Romney's saying, this is not a fantasy land, President Obama. And Donald Rumsfeld saying, his reference to the trained monkey.
I think he said a trained ape could have done a better job in Afghanistan, the former Secretary of Defense. Mm.
Yes. These were disgraceful, insulting, racist, childish comments from these men. I think they both sank to new lows.
Carol, our time is short before the break. Margaret Brennan, Donald Rumsfeld never won for real nuance in his comments, but a trained ape, that's pretty far out there. What about Rumsfeld and Romney's comments this week, Margaret?
Well, certainly you could say it was disrespectful to the presidency, but there were plenty of people who responded to Donald Rumsfeld by saying, hey, have a little bit of perspective and look at the track record of the Bush administration here. And some of the choices made during that time period that obviously didn't play out as that administration had predicted. So I don't think it actually gained much traction, but it certainly did get a lot of pickup in the media and in the press.
Margaret, what is your read right now? The Pentagon still making worried noises about Russian troops movements on the border with Ukraine. Is there real concern in the Obama administration that we might not be finished with Russian troop movements here?
Yes, there's very, very real concern that this was missed on the list of things to be worried about in the world in terms of disruption and instability. Russian incursions into Europe was not one of them. So they're really worried about which next territory might be on Putin's list and how to offset that move.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Russia and the West, Obama, the Pope, Obamacare at 6 million, mudslide, and the plane, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, still missing. Robert Costa is here, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Margaret Brennan covers the U.S. State Department Foreign Affairs for CBS News. Jack Beatty's here. The Obama entourage moved rather quickly through the Vatican, but spent an hour there. The president later called the Pope a wonderful man, described his beliefs in simplicity and spirit over the material world.
People get a sense that first and foremost, he sees himself as a priest and as a disciple of Christ and as somebody who is concerned with the least of these. And nothing's more powerful than someone who seems to live out their convictions.
Jack Beatty, they did not put a microphone in front of the Pope and the president, but there they were for an hour. Mainly it's perhaps it's a photo op, but what about the meeting of these two now?
Well, they both have a similar agenda, at least in part, and that is the agenda of fairness, greater justice, economic justice for the poor. The president even puts it in terms of the middle class. The Pope talks about a church for the poor, and he handed the president, I think it's an encyclical, in any case, a paper in which the Pope is, it's that one that scalds capitalism as a sort of godless system that that creates injustice. And whether the president can take sustenance from that or not, we'll see. I mean, in some ways, both these leaders are alike in another respect. All they have is the bully pulpit. You know, Stalin once said, how many divisions does the Pope have? None. He's got a microphone and he can talk. Well, that's true of the president, too. There isn't anything, really, he can do on his equality agenda. That is blocked by the Republicans, except for perhaps something on the earned income tax credit, which would be, you know, great for the people who'd get it. But otherwise, minimum wage, unemployment, well, they perhaps unemployment in the House, we don't know. Anyway, it doesn't look very promising. And so he's relegated to the bully pulpit, to making big statements about injustice and inequality, but there's not much he can do about it.
Let's bring a little emanation of that meeting back to the United States, where the Supreme Court this week is looking to decide whether corporations under constitutional freedom of religion are entitled to refuse to give coverage for contraception to their employees. Lots of talk about that this week. On Tuesday, they heard arguments about Hobby Lobby's objection and more. Hobby Lobby President Steve Green said that his faith told him his company should not have to provide insurance coverage for IUDs and morning after pills because those offended his religious beliefs. Here he is.
We believe that the principles that are taught scripturally are what we should operate our lives by, and so we cannot be a part of taking life.
There's Mr. Hobby Lobby. Former Clinton administration Solicitor General Walter Dellinger filed a brief citing with the government in this case, laid out his objection to the idea of the court finding for a for-profit company, as a religious organization for purposes of federal law.
The 13,000 employees of the Hobby Lobby corporate enterprise aren't and should not be expected to share the religious beliefs of the Greens. What you really have is one family attempting to utilize their economic leverage to impose their religious beliefs on others.
Robert Costa, what did you see in this court with its conservative majority's argument over this case?
Well, we're still going to have to see, but it was very interesting to listen to some of the arguments. And as someone who covers Republicans and the conservative movement, you see the Hobby Lobby argument really gaining traction on the right, and their objection is that contraceptive drugs and things like that are almost like abortion, and that's their case, and they think that providing coverage for those forms of contraception would make them in some way complicit. But I think what the court has to look at right now is how for-profit corporations, whether they have these extensive rights under the First Amendment to prevent this kind of medical coverage. And I think the lower courts have been divided, and it's going to be very interesting to see how this court, which is so tightly split, actually ends up panning out.
Of course, you've got a conservative majority. You've also got women on this court. They were pretty tough in their questioning from the other side. Elena Kagan saying Congress has given a statutory entitlement. That entitlement is to women and includes contraceptive coverage. And when the employer says, no, I don't want to give that, that woman is directly, quite tangibly harmed, said Kagan. Interesting to see how this works out. Let's go to our listeners, Jerry in Waverly, Iowa. You're on, Jerry.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, if religious rights are given to corporations, then what if someone like Hobby Lobby buys other corporations? For example, if they bought a candy chain, or if they bought a Five and Dime that's breaking down, like Ben Franklin, would that mean all the employees there would either have the option of leaving or subjecting themselves to the religious claims and of the corporation that bought them out? I don't think that would be right.
Jerry, we're not legal scholars here today, but Jack Beatty, my understanding is that if the court rules here that the corporation has that, is entitled to that complexion of belief, that it would extend to all of its policies, whatever it purchased.
Yes, and the swing vote, Anthony Kennedy, we really know how eight of these justices will vote. The swing vote, he asked tough questions of both sides. So it's really hard to know how in this decision expected in June the court will come out. But you're very right. It could come down on a sweeping basis. The Chief Justice indicated, no, maybe we'll just go for privately held corporations. Of course, those are immense, right? They're all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's to step back from this for a moment, historians of the first Gilded Age regard that era's court ruling that corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment. They regard that as a paradigm of the times, an era when, as former President Hayes said in his noted in his diary, quote, we have a government of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations. Now, in the second Gilded Age, the court has found corporate persons have unrestricted rights to speech, and now we may find that they have religious rights. And in a way, I thought Justice Sotomayor asked the key question, how exactly does a for-profit corporation exercise religion? Whose religion? The shareholders, the officers? Perhaps Justice Kennedy will tell us in June.
Janice in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Janice, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Tom, and your guests. I'm Catholic, and I am so for Hobby Lobby and the Catholic bishops and everyone else who is suing over Obamacare. It's just, for me, it's such an unbelievable overreach of the government to try to tell us now, to, you know, our faith that we've had all this time And then they're going to tell him, but now you are going to pay for abortion. You are going to pay for contraceptives. Wait a minute. Are you kidding me? I'm old enough. The government has never told us to do anything like this. And, boy, I'd go to jail for it. If they want to impose this stuff, their beliefs, their secular beliefs on our faith beliefs, it's unconscionable.
Janice, let me ask you, if you or one of your kids, let's say, went to work one day for a corporation that then decided it had some policy that conflicted with your Catholic beliefs, what would you think of that? Would it be entitled under the law?
I would say it has to do, first of all, I'm Catholic. That's number one. Everything else goes under that. So if it goes against my Catholic beliefs, I'm leaving. I have the choice. I'm definitely not going to stay with something that does not follow my own Catholic teaching.
Janice, we've got it loud and clear, and I appreciate your call. One more right on this one, Jeremiah in Watertown, New York. Jeremiah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
Just wanted to say, I think a not-for-profit religious group, they should be exempt from this. They shouldn't have to follow it. But a company as big as Hobby Lobby, they have to decide what's more important, the almighty dollar or almighty God. And you can't run a company based on religious beliefs. They can't expect everyone in that company to follow those religious beliefs that they have with that many people.
Jeremiah, we've got it. Margaret Brennan, I know this isn't your bailiwick, but what do you see coming down here? This would split already that nonprofit religious institutions don't have to follow this part of the Affordable Care Act. Take it to corporations, and you could have this contraception question split off from the rest of the act in lots of companies. Can you see the country tolerating that, Margaret?
Right. No, you worry about a domino effect. Well, you know that behind closed doors, the Pope at the Vatican had a conversation with President Obama about some of the application to religious institutions and the like in terms of the exemption with Obamacare on this issue. When it comes to the private space, it's a really tough question and a tough concept for what precedent this sets for a corporation's religious convictions or the convictions of its leaders to then set the tone for what happens at the office. That then gets into a real private space debate. It's going to be, I don't know that there's the tolerance in the American public at large for what that could mean for them in the reality of the workplace, even though in principle they may be easier to stake out a position on this issue.
We have companies owned by people of all kinds of faiths in this country,
exactly.
And it could be kind of surprising what they longed for or insisted on if they were determined, the corporation, to have a constitutional right. Of course, all this relates directly to Obamacare, very much in the news this week with its an open enrollment deadline on Monday, or it seemed like an enrollment. But then the White House said, well, if you have tried to sign up, just tell us that and we'll let you on into April. Go ahead and do that. Here was Julie Bataille explaining the sign-up extension in a conference call this week.
Just like Election Day, if you are in line when the polls close, you get to vote. We won't close the door on those who tried to get covered and were unable to do so through no fault of their own.
John Boehner had one of his "Are you kidding me?" moments criticizing that extension, yet another extension on Obamacare.
Last night brought us yet another delay of Obamacare, another deadline made meaningless. You know, he hasn't put enough loopholes into the law already. The administration is now resorting to an honor system to enforce it. The hell is this, a joke?
Robert Costa, we've had lots of delays here on mandates and more. Fair for the Obama administration to hold the door open for those who check a box saying, well, I've tried, you know, as if they're in line for the election polls or not?
You're seeing right now with the rising enrollment some Republican nervousness about how to proceed, and I've spoken with House Republican leaders such as Eric Cantor and Kevin McCarthy, and they said their position right now is that as much as people are enrolling, they're still in a political mindset that's focused on repeal. And you're seeing them right now in the House trying to craft an alternative bill, maybe a series of bills that would give the Republican health care plan and be a messaging document of sorts ahead of the midterm elections.
So Republican unease, but I'm also sensing unease in the Obama administration about whether there, despite the reaching 6 million, whether there are enough people in individual states to make all this work, Robert.
I think that's right. And I think when you look at what happened in Florida's 13th congressional district with David Jolly, concerns about the Affordable Care Act, its implementation, are still very much on the political radar. And Democrats are wary. You had Alex Zink in Florida running on fixing it, not repealing it. But whether that fix-it argument will resonate for Democrats remains to be seen.
Jack Beatty, what do you see unfolding on the Obamacare front at this point? March 31st was to be the deadline, some extension there. They've got their 6 million. Steady as she goes, or still open questions?
A lot of open questions. And to me, one of the big ones is the who's signing up? Republicans say it's insured people who are mostly signing up. I don't know whether the figures bear that out at all or not. But a poll this week from Kaiser Health found that 6 in 10 uninsured Americans didn't know about the deadline. Think of that. 6 in 10 had no idea about this deadline, and only 11% of the uninsured said that they had been contacted by text, by phone, by smoke signal, whatever, to telling them about this. That's a tremendous failure of connection, of messaging, of mobilization by the administration.
Let's talk about another issue of messaging. Chris Christie's had his own unease in recent weeks after the Bridgegate traffic jam that he allegedly was put in place as political revenge last night after the release of a report commissioned by the Republican New Jersey governor, his own office, and lawyers in that report found no evidence of his involvement in the lane closing scandal. Chris Christie spoke with ABC News Diane Sawyer about the scandal.
When things were first reported, I said, this can't possibly be true, because who would do something like that? Sometimes people do inexplicably stupid things. And so that's what makes it so hard then to, as the guy in charge, none of it made any sense to me. And to some extent, still does not.
It just doesn't make sense to me. Robert Costa, is Chris Christie getting out of his traffic jam?
I wouldn't say so. And this report was presented by his own attorney, Randy Mastro. And you see Christie this week, though, trying to reassert himself with Republican donors, with the Republican establishment. He's out in Las Vegas yesterday meeting with Sheldon Adelson. He's going to have a press conference today to try to show that he can move beyond. He sat down with an emotional interview with Diane Sawyer in ABC News. He's going to sit down with the Fox News Tonight, Megyn Kelly. So this is very much a PR campaign, a campaign to get Christie back on track. But there's a lot of skepticism even within Republican ranks whether this one-time star, real conservative darling, can really come back.
Jack, what did you see in this conversation with Diane Sawyer last night?
Well, Sawyer asked him whether his bullying style of government may have inspired his, his aides to seek revenge against the Democratic mayor of Fort Lee. And he said, anyone who knows me knows that I would not want people doing stupid things. And that resonated with me. He's also called Bridget Kelly, his former deputy chief of staff, stupid. And speaking of stupid, one wonders if it was wise of Christie's lawyers in this document to heap sexist scorn on Kelly, Bridget Kelly. If she tells investigators that Christie ordered or knew about Bridgegate, he's finished as a presidential candidate and maybe as a governor. And yet this report attributes makes her seem as if she's an aggrieved lover of somebody, and so she can't communicate, and she's taking out her emotions inexplicably on Fort Lee. This is 1950s stuff, and and it could come back to hurt Governor Christie.
Margaret, do you have a smell a whiff of a sexist scorn there?
No.
Okay. All right. Duly noted. We'll see what she makes of it. Of course, what Ms. Kelly has to say is what could really matter to Chris Christie in the end. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. In other news this week, First Lady Michelle Obama and her daughters in China paid a visit to some hungry pandas eating bamboo. They're chowing down, she says.
Look at that one in the back. Oh, they're chowing down.
Three Secret Service agents sent home from Europe after an incident of falling down drunkenness. Stephen Colbert had words for them.
The Secret Service should not have gotten drunk on the job. For Pete's sake, they were in Amsterdam. They should have gotten stoned.
And a big ruling gives Northwestern University football players the right to unionize. Former college quarterback King Coulter led the push toward pay.
We're a big part of what, you know, college sports is today and the revenue that's generated off of it. And we deserve to have a say in that. We deserve a seat at the table.
We're looking at a week in the news, Russia and the West, Obama and the Pope, Obamacare at 6 million, mudslide, the plane still missing, Malaysian Airlines flight. Margaret Brennan is with us from CBS News, Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post, and Jack Beatty. Lots of responses on many fronts this hour, including HLB writes on the Supreme Court and religious exemption. Should the Supreme Court give it to corporations? He says, sure, they've given them everything else. Why not a get-out-of-jail-free card or mints on their pillows? But there are many other views there as well. Let's see. Where do we go? Maybe we go to the Malaysian Airlines flight. It's dominated the news for weeks now. It just off the screen. We were told this week lots of debris they're finding, but so much detritus in the Indian Ocean, it's hard to tell what's what. And then just today, the location moved by 700 miles. Margaret Brennan, in your reading of all this, are we any closer to understanding where it went down, to finding definitive wreckage, to understanding what happened?
Well, for my colleagues on the ground in Australia, in China, in Malaysia, I mean, it sounds like bit by bit you're collecting more shots, essentially, to lay up together, to try to piece together a timeline and perhaps some satellite information that could show you where some possible debris could be located. But honestly, I mean, in here in Washington, there's this sort of shrugging of the shoulders, saying the public loves this story. It's an incredible mystery that has been eating up so much airtime. But on the foreign policy scale, it shouldn't be all plain and a little Ukraine. There's a lot of important stuff happening in the world right now and things that the public should be more concerned about, including these incursions, as you've talked about, by Russia into Eastern Europe, what's happening in Syria right now, which has become a national security threat directly to the United States, according to many U.S. officials who are worried about terrorism coming here, involving planes or otherwise, by those trained fighters who are going to be returning to Europe and returning to the U.S., dozens of them, from Syria. And next week, you've got this election in Afghanistan as well to try to put a new president in place to take over from Karzai. And that could help determine whether or not American troops stay in a significant number past 2014 there.
Saudi Arabia, related to all those stories and more, the president sitting down with the Saudi king and more today in Saudi Arabia. What's on the agenda there, Margaret?
Well, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia is, by all accounts, incandescent about U.S. policy. He's furious in regard to the U.S. decision not to intervene in Syria or to really stake a winner that they want to see in this conflict, in part because they see this as a proxy war with Iran. Iran's backing Assad. Iran's a longtime foe of Saudi Arabia. Add on top of that, they see it as adding insult to injury, the fact that their longtime ally, the United States, was secretly talking to their longtime foe, Iran, behind their back to get those nuclear discussions going, the ones that are now public in terms of trying to come up with a diplomatic deal so that Iran doesn't develop a nuclear weapon. So there's a lot at the top of his agenda. What we do expect is for the president to talk about ramping up some U.S. support for rebels fighting in the south of Syria, but don't expect a big news release. That's going to stay private.
What kind of support would that be, and why the south?
What we've seen and heard in recent weeks, particularly from the rebels and from Arab diplomats, is that the south is a place that really the rebels could make some headway. In the north, you've seen some of the Islamic extremists gain territory, and they have started to attack the moderates that the U.S. has backed. So the North has really sort of gone against the rebels, but the South is a place they could make some headway. You have seen delivery of weapons through the South, some of it heavier arms. Some of it is still in the pipeline, but the U.S. will help facilitate the delivery. Even if we're not buying the weapons, there's more of a giving of a green light to some of the fighters, some of which we have trained through some of our agencies. There are many on Capitol Hill who'd like to see that scaled up for the Pentagon to actually play a role here. But at this point, the administration is being restrained, but they're doing more than they were before.
And, of course, the news out of Egypt this week ties in here. You tell us how 529 Muslim Brotherhood members sentenced to death in connection with the murder of a police officer after a very fast trial in Egypt. There was protest against that earlier this week. Margaret Brennan, is that sentencing for real? I know there's an appeal process here. Is that number likely to be cut down? Could they really take 500-plus people out and execute them over this single police officer's death?
Well, Secretary Kerry said this defies logic, the fact that you could have such large-scale sentencing and it's sort of a farce that you could really have a real investigation and trial all at once. The bigger picture and the question here for Egypt and the thing that the U.S. is concerned about is, by doing something like this, are you creating an insurgency? Are you taking the Muslim Brotherhood from being out front as a political party? You took them out of the closet and allowed them to run an election and become a party that seemed to be kind of incompetent when it came to running the country in a way that addressed some of the economic issues. And, you know, running the garbage trucks down the street is a lot harder when you're the ruling party than it is when you're the opposition just criticizing the guy in charge. But now, by doing something like this, the worry is you're pushing them back underground, and you could really make this more of a military confrontation and less of a political standoff. So the worry is that this could go from a large-scale sentencing to a large-scale conflict in some ways, particularly along the Sinai.
Jack Beatty, I cannot remember a time when the politics, the geopolitics of the Middle East looked so fluid as the president sits down decades, what, 6 or 7 decades of a U.S.-Saudi kind of quiet alliance here, and even that up in the air right now.
Yes, and even in terms of resources, I mean, in 50 years, Saudi Arabia may just be a place in the sand without much else to do. I mean, we're fast on our way to energy independence. The president, even in Europe, said we're going to speed up licensing to get more natural gas to Europe, and he told the Europeans, start doing your own fracking. Well, none of that is good news for Saudi Arabia. However, our interest in the Gulf remain, at least until this age is past. And that's the danger, I think, of the Iran imbroglio, that our hawks are forever saying, oh, well, we got to be ready to strike them. If we strike them, they're going to strike at the Gulf, and everybody's economy is going to suffer.
Robert Costa, the NSA and its large-scale data collection inside the United States on the president's agenda this week. He told reporters in the Netherlands that his team has given him a workable option for NSA reform that he said would eliminate concerns about how the government keeps records, known as metadata. I want to ask you about that. Here's the president.
Overall, I'm confident that it allows us to do what is necessary in order to deal with the dangers of a terrorist attack, but does so in a way that addresses some of the concerns that people had raised.
Robert Costa, are we back to the idea of a private firm holding this metadata and on the government's behalf, and therefore it's not a problem?
I think that's where things seem to be trending, at least on Capitol Hill. You have the Obama administration and the Republican House of Representatives somewhat aligned and in trying to transfer some storage of this data to private companies. But I think you're going to see a debate over the next few weeks and months about who gets to approve, who gets the records, the role of judges in the process. But I think there's definitely a turn in both parties against these current surveillance programs, and I think that'll play out with legislation.
This requires a sign-off by Congress, this change in policy on NSA metadata.
Congress certainly wants to be involved. I'm not exactly sure of what's required. What the president has certain abilities as the executive to make decisions on intelligence. But I think in terms of the large-scale program, Congress is certainly very active right now.
Hard to know exactly how much real and significant reform takes place there until we see, if we ever see. Sharon in Nashville, Tennessee. Sharon, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question concerning this mudslide is, with given the history of those slides in that area, who is responsible for allowing that land to be built on? Is it county, state, real estate agents with profits in mind? No matter who's responsible, this is entirely unconscionable to have all of these people, how many other places were lives are at stake for the same situation?
Yeah, Sharon, thanks for your call. I mean, we talked about this on the show yesterday. There are, especially in the West, but not only in the West, plenty of places. I mean, I don't know about a mudslide as big as this threatened, but plenty of places where there's danger. We get here, Jack Beatty, right into issues of private property. Of course, there could have been zoning changes by local officials here, and I think that's where responsibility at this point would lie. But property rights are also very strong as well, and people have been loath to say, no, you can't put a house up there, even if something terrible could happen down the road. And not only there, I mean, look up and down our coasts and beyond.
Yes, yes. I mean, and in the West, more and more people are moving out into these places that hitherto weren't thought to be habitable. And, you know, there's an economic dimension to this, too. Just reading about this town, you know, hard scrabble, logging. Many of those homes were mobile homes, people making their living, you know, their lives there. And there's a kind of pathos to it. Obviously, it's a tragedy, but there's also a sort of, you know, economic pathos to it. People trying to live their lives almost on the edge of things because that's the only place they can afford.
Let's go to JT in Bowling Green, Kentucky. JT, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to make a comment on the Northwestern college football players, the thing they're going through. You know, these players devote a lot of their time and their lives to these football teams, and you know, it's unfair and quite frankly selfish that these college teams and all these TV networks make all this money off what these college players are doing, and these college players don't, and want to say these college players don't deserve medical benefits or further payment for it at all. You know, they're treated as employees in every other way other than that. If they don't come to practice or if their behavior is bad, they're reprimanded like an employee would be at work.
Yeah, JT, I'm glad for your call. Our time grows short, but let us pick it up. It's so interesting. I can well imagine, Robert Custa, I don't know if you're a football fan, but it wouldn't have been too many years ago, and I think the immediate sentiment would have been the other way. Come on, this is college ball. What are they talking about, unions and sharing in revenue? But sentiment seems to be changing. We've got this National Labor Relations Board ruling that at Northwestern University, football players may have the right to form a union, bargain collectively. Billions of dollars, of course, nationally coming into the National Collegiate Athletic Association. And our caller JT is not alone any longer, Robert, in wondering if maybe that ought to be shared with these young players who devote so much effort to it.
I think when you look at someone like Johnny Manziel, from Texas A&M, won the Heisman Trophy. He got in some trouble for maybe signing an autograph and getting some payment for an autograph last year. There's such a market now around college sports. You're right, Tom. I think traditionally the education has been the reward for college athletes, but it's become a billion-dollar business, college sports. And at some point, some of these athletes who are not only giving their time and their effort, but they're giving much of their bodies and the physical toll it takes, I think some kind of compensation beyond the degree and the classes that are offered is probably in the works.
It looks like it may well be. I want to talk for a moment about two big figures who died this week. James R. Schlesinger, one, and Jonathan Schell, another. Schlesinger, a tough Cold War strategist, advocate of nuclear power, served as Secretary of Defense under Presidents Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, was the country's first Secretary of Energy under Jimmy Carter. He died Thursday in Baltimore. Here's some tape he spoke during the 2010 U.S. Strategic Command Deterrence Symposium in Omaha, Nebraska, about the essence of his professional career.
The essential mission remains deterrence, and deterrence is indispensable if we are to avoid major war. And that sometimes earns some scorn from the left, given the means for preserving peace, but it continues to be the relevant motto, peace is our profession.
A strategy man, a tough guy. His resonance this week in, as he passes Margaret Brennan, as we look at NATO, Europe, Russia, and all the rest.
Right. No, it's really interesting to look back and see the kind of hardline strategy someone like Schlesinger had in terms of how he saw the world. I mean, you went through the list of titles he had: Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Energy, CIA Director. But one of the things that really he became known for was his time at the Pentagon. It was really short, but it was only 2 years, but it was during such a key period that you described. But one of his big legacies is helping to build a stronger NATO to counter Soviet influence. That's something that now we're going to be revisiting even as soon as next week. And I think that was a key bite to talk about the power of deterrence, because he really was a proponent of making sure the Pentagon had the money to do the things not only that it needed to do, but what it might want to do or what it might scare others in terms of the possibility of what it could do with these vast resources at its disposal. And right now you see such a different strategy. The White House's strategy has really been about punishment rather than deterrence, punishing with sanctions, not to stop Putin, but to show him there's a cost for his action. Whereas then it was, don't even think about it, was sort of the more hardline worldview. It's not a clear, it's not the same situation. We are not in a position where Russia is a Soviet empire. It's regional, according to President Obama, but it's an interesting perspective to see how the world's changed.
Jack Beatty, Jonathan Schell, a very different tone. Anti-war activists condemned wars in Vietnam and Iraq and gone this week. Big boys.
Yes, it seems fitting to send him off with a line from Matthew Arnold's Rugby Chapel, a tribute to his father. And the line is, when the foots of folly fall, let them find thy body by the wall.
Jonathan Schell, who wrote so eloquently about the dangers of nuclear weapons accumulation and mindless rush to war. Two big figures gone this week. Margaret Brennan with CBS News. Thank you very much for joining us today, Margaret.
Thank you.
Robert Costa, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.